Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Try these numbers on for size. In 1900, 10% of the world's population lived in cities. 5 years ago, the figure reached 50%. By 2050, it's likely to be 75%. Obviously, there's a massive shift going on, and a new documentary examines how city leaders all over the planet are balancing all these competing demands of housing, mobility, public space, civic engagement, economic development, and even environmental policy. It's a load, and some cities are thriving under the new demands, while others are struggling. One of documentarian Gary Huftwit's aims is to reconnect these issues with the public. His film Urbanize does just that. Later on this hour, MSNBC's Rachel Maddow. But first up, our cities. Gary Huftwit is an independent filmmaker who has produced 8 feature documentaries, including the award-winning I Am Trying to Break Your Heart about the band Wilco. He's just wrapping up a trilogy on the world of design, and he joins us this morning from the studios of Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence. And Gary, good morning. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
I'm just wondering, why are some cities growing at the pace they are, and why are some cities not? What's behind all that?
Well, I guess it depends on where you are in the world. In the global south, like in India, for instance, the cities are where the jobs are and the cities where the money is.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got millions and millions of people flooding into the cities because that's where the opportunity is. So that's a big driver. In other cities, in other countries, some cities are shrinking. And that's the kind of situation I think we see with a lot of the cities here in the United States. It's a push and pull. Cities are competing for people.
Yeah, but weren't cities sort of focal points for jobs even 150, 200 years ago? Or the fact that we were more agrarian worldwide, was that sort of the difference maker at that time?
I think so. And you had cities that were really kind of built around manufacturing. I mean, Detroit, you know, is a kind of a perfect example. But I think as those agrarian jobs have completely, you know, almost vanished in most places, the cities are just becoming more and more concentrated areas for economic growth. So that's where people need to go. And everything for education, for health, all these reasons are why people are coming to cities more.
You know, Gary, your film makes such a great point, which is that any system that experiences this kind of increase in demand is going to be stressed. What types of stresses are cities under these days as you traveled around the globe to examine different ones?
Well, I mean, a lot of the big cities, it's housing. It's what to do with millions of people who are coming into a city who are generally of lower income and trying to find a place to live. So you've got cities like Mumbai, where the slum population is, I think, 6 or 7 million people now living in slums, and that'll increase, you know, twofold in the next 20 years. So it's really about trying to, I guess, kind of plan for that sort of informal growth, and try to provide some services and try to provide some structure for that growth.
You know, the photographs, the film of Mumbai, I thought was just absolutely staggering, what you showed there and the kinds of stresses people are under. What did you find there when it comes to bathroom facilities and that kind of thing? Because those numbers just took my breath away, to be honest with you. On my Easter Sunday, to be honest with you, Gary.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, in Mumbai specifically, I think the sanitation standards, I think if there's one toilet for every 50 people in these more informal areas of the city, that's considered adequate sanitation. But right now, I think the ratio is 600 people to a toilet.
Yeah.
So if you can imagine, it's really just open sewage trenches, and basically you defecate wherever you can because there just simply isn't sanitation there.
And do you see that as you go around that part of the city? Is that just a common sight?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
I think anyone who's been to Mumbai can – it's a fascinating city. It's one of the most chaotic cities I've ever been to. It makes New York look like a mountain retreat.
Now, that's an analogy for you.
It's interesting because there's so much foreign investment and there's so much economic growth there. And at the same time, there's just this incredible poverty. So it's coexisting and sort of clashing.
You point out that I think 33% of new urban dwellers these days live in slums.
Yeah.
Man.
And that's in cities in, you know, in South America. And again, it's predominantly in the global south. And, you know, cities in the more developed nations have got their own challenges.
Yeah. You know, as you traveled the globe and looked at different cities, were there things that surprised you, or was it pretty much sort of what you expected to find as you made your tour here?
Well, you know, I was specifically looking at kind of design projects, whether they were professionally driven by cities or by architects, or whether they were citizen driven, just sort of this kind of there was a real new wave of kind of DIY urbanism, which is something that I saw more and more around the world, which is citizens just getting involved and taking matters into their own hands, whether it's just because their city government isn't doing something that they feel should be done. But that's something that I saw more and more all across the world, and it's something that we look at several projects in the film that are, really sort of very micro scale and very kind of modest, but I think have a huge impact on a city when people really get involved.
For example, you're talking about what?
Well, I mean, as simple as something like in Detroit, people kind of taking over vacant lots that are on their block and turning them into, you know, green space and community centers and community gardens. I think we've got to get citizens involved. So much of the time we kind of take these things for granted. We might live in a city and we might complain when something is, not how we want it. But very few of us take that extra step to actually get involved and actually do something, and either through official or unofficial channels.
Yeah, that's funny, because a lot of times you do wonder about that. People say your sewer is clogged out in the street with leaves and grass, and folks call the city. Why don't you just go out and clean it out yourself sometimes? There is a real disconnect in some ways between places where we live and who's responsible for keeping them up.
Yeah, well, I mean, we pay taxes, and we expect some services to be taken care of for that. But I think it's just about that sort of pride in your neighborhood and in your city, and just going that extra mile when you see something that needs to be changed, you just got to do it.
Is there a city on this planet, Gary, that is sort of recognized as being the perfect city that's sort of on the cutting edge of most of these massive shifts you're talking about out there?
No. I think what I found is there are a lot of cities that do certain things well, but there's no perfect city. I mean, there are so many competing interests and philosophies and agendas and kind of geographic and economic situations that there is no perfect city. So you've got a city like maybe Copenhagen, which is kind of, I think, really figured out bicycling and pedestrianism. I mean, they've now have 40% of people there commute to work on a bicycle.
That's just a staggering number to me, 40%. And again, the film of those folks streaming into the downtown area every day was just magnificent, I guess, on some levels.
Yeah. Well, they've for, 20 or 30 years now have invited that kind of behavior. And I think that's an important thing to realize, that it's about invitation. It's about a city kind of gets the kind of behavior that it invites. It's not a situation where you can kind of put a Band-Aid on one thing, whether it's traffic or sprawl or development, and the next year it's gone. It's a long-term process. And in that case, in Copenhagen, again, they've been encouraging biking. They've been building safe bicycle lanes that are separated from the normal automobile traffic.
Yeah, listen to that. What they did there, I thought, was so interesting, because they actually moved their bike lanes next to sidewalks, and then they placed areas for parked cars along the streets next to the faster moving traffic out there, which made the idea that the bicyclists are really separated from the traffic by a good buffer there of parked cars.
Yeah, a line of parked cars.
I thought, what a smart thing to do.
Yeah, it's the parked cars protecting the bicyclists instead of the bicyclists protecting the parked cars, which is the normal bike lane kind of situation we have in this country, where it's just lines painted on the street.
Yeah,
outside of the line of parked cars. So they've sort of flipped that model. But in some cities like New York has now changed and is moving the parked cars out into the street and leaving that buffer zone in between for bikes.
What was it like for you seeing all those people in Copenhagen arriving for work on their bicycles?
I mean, I think it's great. I think as citizens, we should have options. That's my biggest thing. I don't want to be forced to drive every single day if I don't want to. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be forced to bicycle every single day if I don't want to. But I want to have those options between automobiles, between public transportation, between walking, bicycling. I think we should be able to kind of figure out how to have all those things.
How big an issue is the lack of space for growth? What are you finding out there?
The lack of space for
growth?
Yeah.
There's just no room to grow and expand in some of these really compact cities.
Well, look, I mean, some of these places, I mean, that's where you get sprawl. I mean, you've got housing development outside the city center because there is no more room for growth. So it really depends on the geography and the demand in those cities for housing. But, you look at a city like Phoenix or even Kansas City, there's more housing development outside the city center because that's where the land's available and that's where it's cheaper. And this whole idea of drive till you qualify is something that you basically, the further you get from the city center, the more you can get for your money, and that's led to, what we kind of refer to as sprawl.
Some people say that's changing, that sprawl no longer is the hip thing, that living downtown, living around others is becoming more accepted. Did you see that as you got out there?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely kind of this redevelopment of the downtowns that you start to see where it's, converting factory buildings into lofts and that sort of thing. But, certain people want the 3/4-acre lot and the swimming pool, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. If those communities are planned smartly and there are public transport options into the city, it's not just, thousands and thousands of homes being built by these massive home builders with no thought to what people do. Where do they shop? Where do they, have recreation? And those are the kind of problems that really kind of come on with sprawl.
We're visiting with documentary filmmaker Gary Hustwit about his new film, Urbanized. And I should point out that Urbanized will be screened along with a question and answer session this evening at 7 at Woodruff Auditorium over on the KU campus. Your questions about urban design, sprawl, anything else, Gary Hustwit has seen a lot as he made his film, Urbanized. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address is up to date at kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Gary, let's step back just for a moment here. Who is responsible these days for shaping our cities? Who are the people who carry that responsibility, and how do they go about doing it?
Well, in theory, it's our city government and our city planning departments. I think in practice, it's commercial developers.
Really?
I think that they're really driving the growth and driving the development. And again, cities are competing for people. They're competing for jobs. They're competing for that investment. I think many times the developers really kind of have their way in terms of built where they're going to build and what the services that they're going to provide are. I think that it's very hard for cities to kind of want to scare away that money by putting kind of more stricter regulations and trying to kind of make the developers do things that are more in the interest of the general public versus just their bottom line.
So you're saying that commercial developers these days can trump city planning, saying, hey, we want to build our building here. The zoning isn't quite right, but if you want us, you're going to have to let us build there.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
And that happens all the time.
Yeah, and the same thing with housing developments. I mean, cities want the building, the construction jobs, and the tax base, and that the investment. So, I think especially now it's hard for cities to kind of turn that away or to kind of put any roadblocks in place for that kind of development.
So, what does that say then for the future of urban design, for the future of city planning, if planners really at the end of the day are always being trumped by commercial developers?
Well, I mean, I just think that they need to kind of enforce that kind of, I think smarter thinking about how cities should be shaped. And the more we as citizens get involved and kind of express, you know, what our desires are, I think that's really the key. Because, I mean, you know, really we're running these cities. I mean, we're electing people, and we're the ones who are buying these houses and, you know, patronizing these businesses. So in a sense, you know, you get the city that you deserve in terms of how much you're involved in it. And I think that more public involvement, and not just when we're against something that the city or a developer is doing, but really getting involved to kind of, just express what our dreams are for the city. What type of city do we want to live in? You know, these are the things that are important to me, whether it's public space or transportation or lower income housing or whatever it is. Just getting that message out and getting involved and trying to make it happen.
You mentioned a few minutes ago, Gary, this idea of sprawl, which is a huge issue here in the heartland with Kansas City, a city that has so much available space to it. What strategies did you come across? How are cities dealing with sprawl and to sort of bring the cities back, to pull a concentration back towards the city centers?
Well, I mean, there's got to be some sort of, it's called transit-oriented development, where you're not just relying on automobile traffic to get people from the suburbs into the city. And also trying to kind of make the suburbs less of just a residential area and more mixed use, more businesses, more offices. So you're not having this kind of, you know, this downtown kind of commute every day. I mean, those are some of the ways I think the idea of making communities a little bit more compact and a little bit more connected. I think those are the kind of the two, real areas that trying to push.
You know, we're sitting here talking about cities like there's, you know, a formula for successful cities and everything else and all these competing pressures. One other pressure that's out there, and you talk about this in Urbanized, is this idea of what's hip today, what people want today may be different than what they want 20, 30, 40 years down the road. So you put in all this infrastructure, you make this big push in one direction, and then suddenly down the road things change.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look at how the internet and just kind of communications technology has changed the way we live already. The kind of idea of working from home or telecommuting is much more prevalent. And the idea of physically having to be in a specific space every day is changing, I think, for a lot of people. So I think it's interesting to see what that effect is going to be on cities in the future. I mean, we want that the social aspect of cities. You want sort of the unexpectedness of walking down the street and being surprised by something that you haven't seen before, you didn't realize was there. So while we want those things and we want to be able to gather in big groups for events, at the same time, I think we want the freedom to not do that. And that's, one of the challenges, I think, that we'll see going forward.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here on UpToDate, our email address, update@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. What do you hope this film does for folks who watch it, Gary? What's your hope for it?
Well, you know, I'm someone who's kind of obsessed with all the the thinking and the creativity and the work that goes into the things we take for granted, whether it's fonts or, the kind of manufactured objects we surround ourselves with or our cities. And I think the design of cities is probably the biggest area of where design has an impact on our lives, since right, the minute you walk out your door every day, your life and your movements are really dictated by the design of your city. So, I mean, I'm interested in kind of seeing the decision making and the philosophy and the strategy and the reasons behind all this stuff,
mm-hmm.
and I'm hoping that other people are interested in these things too. Because when you know more about the process and know more about you know, how things are done and why, then you, I think you kind of gain a better understanding of what your relationship is to this design and how what your role is and how you can get involved to change it.
You know, you have some great footage of the woman who is the lead planner for New York City, and you're in her office, you're watching her meet with people, looking at plans and everything else. Tell us about that. Take us into that room, and what was that like?
Amanda Burden is the planning commissioner under Mayor Bloomberg. She's been responsible for a lot of, I think, pretty innovative planning there. One thing that she championed was the High Line, which was an elevated rail track that ran about 30 blocks on the west side of the city that hadn't been used for 50 years, which is kind of this rusting elevated train track. Which was converted into a park, an elevated park, and is now one of the most popular attractions in the city. Hmm. You can kind of walk, and you're 50 feet in the air, so you're kind of walking through the city, but you're above the city.
I had the impression that it was actual citizens themselves who sort of took the ball in that case.
Yeah.
We were talking before about citizen involvement and citizen engagement.
Yep.
They grabbed the ball and ran and said, hey, let's go this way with this thing.
Yeah, that's a perfect example. There were just two guys who lived in the neighborhood who kind of, had a different vision for what that elevated track could be and formed a citizens group, called Save the High Line or Friends of the High Line. And they just started, raising funds and raising awareness. And eventually the city took it on and then, really got a lot of the investment. But most of the money that was used to redevelop the High Line came from private donors and ordinary citizens.
And one of your points in this film is that there's this need for new innovators out there to deal with all these issues. And right there might be just a classic example of it.
Yeah. Well, again, I think it is about citizen involvement. There's obviously a huge role for professionals and we need the kind of the muscle of the city government to get a lot of these things done. But I think a lot of times the best examples, kind of best ideas come from people that are not trained professionals. They're people who are actually kind of living these realities I encourage people to kind of get together with friends, on a Saturday and brainstorm, solutions to some problem on your block or in your neighborhood or in your city, because we need that kind of energy and those kind of ideas that are not just coming from the professional sector.
Let's go to some phone calls here at 816-235-2888. What should Kansas City look like to you 10 or 20 years down the road? Tell us about your fantasy for Kansas City. Let's see if our guest, Gary Hustwit, has seen it happen in other places. 816-235-2888. Our email address, update@kcur.org. Kite from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, Kite. Go ahead, Kite.
Council's recent Transportation Outlook 2040 study, you'll see that the continuation of the sprawl pattern that we've been working on.
Hey, Kite, we're going to have once you call back on a landline, Kite, we're losing you here, just not able to keep up with you here. Let's go to a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation about cities around the world and what Gary Hustwit saw as he made his film Urbanized. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed Friday's discussion with the book doctors, you'll find that in all of our broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, veterinarian Dr. Wayne Hunhausen is back with us. We're visiting with Gary Hustwit this morning. He's a documentary filmmaker whose new film is titled Urbanized. It's a look at city planning and the challenges facing city all across the globe. We're looking for your ideas, what you want Kansas City to look like 10 or 20 years from now. Tell us about your fantasies for our town, and let's see if our guest Gary Hustwit has seen it happen in other places. 816-235-2888, our email address, update@kcur.org. Let's go to Kite Singleton, who's called back again from Kansas City, Missouri. He's an urban planner. Kite, good morning.
Steve, I'm sorry. I guess I broke up with you.
Yeah.
I don't know if you heard what I was saying about the Transportation Outlook 2040 that Mid-America Regional Council has recently completed.
No. Go ahead.
Well, what it shows is that if we continue on the sprawl pattern that we've been using for the last 50, 60 years, we're going to spend some $5 billion more of taxpayer money on infrastructure extensions. And you see recently that City of Kansas City is looking at extending out further toward the airport into farmland. And the other thing that we do if we continue on this pattern is to use up our farmland and extend our service line so much that it increases the cost of urban development significantly.
And what pressures, Kite, do you see happening in Kansas City that might reverse that trend?
Well, I think if you look at the Jackson County proposals that Mike Sanders is pursuing for rail connections to centers like Blue Springs or Pleasant Hill or Lee Summit or Raytown, that's the kind of thing that changes the way urban development works. You have a place where a transit vehicle stops, and at that point, people begin to invest around it with businesses or apartments to make a clustered development. You look at the development of the state of Virginia just south of the Potomac River over the last 30 years. It's been so a great demonstration of how that kind of transit-oriented development actually works.
And Gary, as you look at cities around the world, have you seen changes made when it comes to stopping sprawl?
Yeah, I mean, in California, for example, you've got they've just enacted a kind of sprawl tax, which basically is, charging the developers kind of more for really kind of the future expenses that are going to be kind of, attached to that kind of development. But, Kai, I think that was a really good point, the transit-oriented development issues.
Is there a mindset here, Kite Singleton, that will allow developers here to face the same kind of sprawl tax that Gary just mentioned?
Well, I think, for example, if you look at this development that's being proposed out toward the airport, there are a lot of the sewer lines that haven't been put in. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's been talked about is if a developer wants to put in a new development, let him build the sewer line. Mm-hmm. The opposite way is to extend those service lines with taxpayer money, and that just encourages this kind of development that's eating up the farmland and causing cities to have budget problems because you try to do new schools, you try to do police and fire service into those extended sprawl developments with 1 acre and a half acre lots, in some cases 5 acre lots. You're talking about per capita service that's out of control.
Yeah, right.
That's the real problem. And if you ask the developers to extend those lines and pay for them, then that's a different kettle of fish.
Yeah,
and
right.
It tends to discourage them that way, and then you get more development at the nodes. Places like Liberty, talk about Liberty North of the river, mm-hmm. Liberty or Gladstone. That's the way I think intelligent moving forward. And I refer again to the Mid-America Regional Council,
right?
Outlook 2040. It sets it out pretty clearly.
Kite, I'm glad you called in. Thanks very much.
You bet, Steve. Yeah. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Kite. Let's go to Gary from Kansas City, Missouri. Gary, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. I just had a comment about I'd love to see 20 years from now that we do better on our waterfront areas, whether it's on the plaza, which I just drove by the Kauffman Foundation, and that area looks, neglected, to say the least. But more importantly, I guess, down the Missouri River, where we really haven't, created the right atmosphere to have, development I've lived in San Francisco, I've lived in St. Louis, my wife's from Chicago, and waterfront areas are just abundant and fun. And I think we're missing something here.
Gary, thanks for the phone call. And Gary Huswit, you make that point very clearly in the film when you talk about New York City and Robert Moses, who built those highways right along the seafront
yeah,
there and really cut the city off from the riverfront.
Yeah, I think that that happened in a lot of American cities where you did have highways kind of running along the edge of the waterfront, and it cut the city off from from the water. And now you're seeing cities kind of trying to reverse that, cities like Seattle or also in New York City, and trying to kind of redevelop the waterfront and make it more of a more connected into the city and just part of people's daily lives. I think it's a huge, huge, underutilized asset in a lot of cities, and we're starting to see more of that kind of development.
Well, people might wonder, why on earth did cities cut off their residents from the waterfront? What happened there?
I think it was easier than plowing right through the middle of the city with a highway.
Right.
I think in the 50s and 60s, that was that was modernization. That was, everybody was going to live in the suburbs and drive into the city, and we needed to, have these highways come in. And I think in some places the geography was such that the edges were the easiest part to use for those highways.
Yeah.
So we're just gonna seeing the really the result of that now, and just starting to realize that it was a big mistake, and we should be reconnected to the water.
What do you want Kansas City to look like 10 or 20 years from now? Again, our phone number, 816-235-2888, our email address, update@kcur.org. Barbara from Gladstone, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I just have two quick comments, and I'll take his comments off the air. I was involved with a community group who was trying to reuse a shopping center in the Northland, and I went to several meetings over several years to prevent the property from going to blight. It is night blight now. We did everything we could with community groups that drew from other parts of the city to come in and see what was going to happen, and ultimately one night the developers showed up. And everything changed the night they showed up in every way. They had maps and pictures and laws that were in place. And I left that meeting and said to my husband, now I understand. All the control of this has been in the hands of the developers, and we did not realize it. The second thing I want to say is that I am constantly railing about the lack of beauty in our city. And if I have something that I want in the 10 to 20 years, it's beauty. There are places in this city where there is great beauty. There are places where it is strip shopping centers, the foundations of which will crumble. They are temporary. They are not intended to last a long time, and they are not beautiful.
Right.
And I think beauty is the biggest thing we're lacking in cities. He's exactly right. You walk out the door, and we're a part of that environment. But beauty can be in the smallest things, landscaping, stone, the curve of the road, the things that architects know how to do. And it's the thing that I see that I am the most hungry for is beauty. I'll take his comments off the air, and I thank you for the program.
Yeah, what a great set of points there, Barbara. You know, Gary, in public spaces, you make the point in the film that the eye can only take in so much. I think you said 100 meters by 100 meters. And that suggests what? That there's a need for, what, smaller public spaces that focus more on beauty, as Barbara just pointed out?
Yeah, well, that harkens back to kind of the old public squares of European cities, which, those are the dimensions, because really you need that scale, that human scale. And I think a lot of times that is overlooked. But, yeah, I think she has a great point about beauty. It's interesting that in the early 1900s, there's a movement called the City Beautiful Movement, which had a big impact on Kansas City's development.
Mm-hmm.
But it was trying to bring in that, the kind of classic architecture and public space design of old Europe and some of those cities into American cities, because we really didn't have a tradition of that sort of an architectural tradition here. But it was that idea that beautiful spaces and beautiful areas of the cities just kind of enrich everybody's lives. That was the focus then and should be now. But she had a really good point about the developers, too. I mean, in that case, it really is about the city getting involved and taking over those blighted spaces and trying to come up with the community, come up with a better use. That's what you're seeing in cities like, Detroit is probably a good example of that, too, where it's just gotten to the point where there is no, you know, there's no other choice. You've kind of, the city has to step in and take control of these spaces from the owners.
You talk again in the film about these very neat ideas for public spaces and the keys to building community, which can involve even small things such as movable chairs, different types of things to sit on top of, different shapes of things to sit on top of. Why are those things such a big deal? I imagine they're easily overlooked so often.
Again, it's about the details. It's about kind of really looking at how we use public spaces and how people want to use public spaces and making them so that they are flexible and can be used for different things. Well, I mean, one thing I really like is this trend of sort of what they called pop-up urbanism, which is sort of using an area or a street or a parking lot. And for one weekend, it's something completely different. It's this idea of sort of playing with the city's form and the use of the city, but in a temporary way that is kind of inexpensive and is, you know, is easily reversed. There was a thing called Parking Day, which is an annual event, which now takes place all over the world, where people, you put your coins in the meter and you get a parking space, but then you turn it into a park. People laid down grass and put down chairs and had picnics and made kind of temporary museums all in parking spaces. And I think it was an idea just about trying to re-envision what the city could be like. And what the best use is for all this space that in many cities we use now just to park cars.
Mary writes us this: I'd like to see some neighborhood dog parks. Gary, what's the most innovative thing you've seen other cities do about outdoor recreation for man's best friend and the messes they sometimes leave behind?
I live in Manhattan, which is I think dog park heaven probably. Mm-hmm. There seems like there's a dog park on every other block in our
really?
City.
Yeah.
Which, you know, generally anytime you see a public park, there's also a kind of an adjoining dog park there too. So, it's important.
It can make a difference, right? Beth writes us this: while I was driving from Ward Parkway Mall to the plaza, the New Orleans streetcars that went through the boulevards of homes came to mind as I, among the other baby boomers age and yet still want to be independent and at the same time spend less on auto, gas, etc. I thought what a beautiful and easy way it would be for visitors, travelers, and residents to get from different locales, i.e. the zoo or Crown Center. The tree-lined meridians could frame the lines as well. What a great thought there.
Definitely. You know, it's interesting. Another interesting project that has just kind of been put in place in Raleigh, North Carolina, is people weren't really walking around the city. Even if it was something was a very short distance, people would still drive, even if it was like 10 blocks or 20 blocks. And a group of citizens started putting up signs around the city that just kind of had basically an arrow saying what the time would be to walk to a specific place. Like you'd walk down the street and said, it's 5 minutes to, you know, City Hall and an arrow. And just put these around the city so that people kind of realize that, well, you know, God, it's not that hard to walk. It's only going to take me 5 minutes to walk. Where I'm going to go instead of getting in the car, going, parking, et cetera.
Well, speaking of walking, we got to scoot here. But, Gary, thanks so much for your time today. I sure appreciate it. Again, folks
my pleasure.
Can view Urbanize tonight at 7 at Woodruff Auditorium on the KU campus.